Bob Stivers is my name. I teach religion and chair of the Department of Religion at Pacific Lutheran University. I've been in the game of the environment for many, many years, having done a dissertation on it some, well, I won't say how many years ago. Yeah. I'm hoping that this session goes better than one I had a few years ago. I was invited to come and say something about the environment to my daughter's class a number of years ago. She was in about the fourth or fifth grade. And I gave what I thought was a simplified, but now we're to one here. Here's one. We may have to go steal some from the other room.
Sit on the floor.
So Bob, are you ready to start on tape?
Oh, is this tape?
Oh, you bet. We're gonna sell this tape for thousands of dollars.
Yes, you're blackmailing, yeah. Anyway, I was telling a story.
Roll the tape.
Yeah. I was visiting my daughter's class and speaking to these fourth graders about the environment in a way I could, and as the went pretty well, I thought. And as it was over, I wanted to say hello to all the little boys and girls, so they filed past me and shook my hand. And this one little girl came along, and I just happened to ask her, "Well, what did you think of the discussion here?" And the way children were, she said, "Boring." That night, when I got home, my daughter, in order to mollify me a little bit, she said to me, "Dad, don't pay her no mind. She just repeats what everybody else says." I think I'll wait a moment until this chair situation. Okay. I have a number of presentations this week to make. I missed my first one on Monday, which I'm very sorry for because I had something come up. What I want to do tonight is to talk about some of the attitudes that have gotten us into the environmental crisis. Carla Bergdahl has done a great job of doing a lot of that already, and I may just build on what she has done and not take so much time. I want to also spend some time looking at the spectrum of Christian understandings, which are now developing. And later in this week, either tomorrow night I may start, or I think the night after, or Friday night, I have a case study called Snake in the Grass. The Snake in the Grass is a case about a snake in Arizona that is threatened, its whole species is threatened by the construction of a dam. And I will proceed to work from a perspective of Christian ethics to look at that case as a group. So that's my plan, to provide some background in one or two sessions here and try as much as possible to do it in terms of discussion. There are two books I've ordered for the bookstore. One is a book by the Presbyterian Church. A task force was recently concluded, which was developing environmental policy for the Presbyterian Church. We had a Lutheran representative in that group, and now I'm serving on the ELCA task force to develop an environmental statement as a liaison for the Presbyterian Church. This is a good little book if you're interested in one for church study. It's available in the bookstore here, church groups in particular. The other one, the one the case comes out of, is a case book in Christian ethics, which is also up there, put out by four of us, which has a number of cases in Christian ethics, not just environmental ethics, but war, peace ethics, family ethics, questions of medicine, and so forth. So I would just alert you to those two if you're interested. I want to start tonight by trying to engage you in a little discussion. I want to pick up on something that Carla did the other night, and she passed by it so fast that you hardly noticed it, but it was an interesting question. And I want to tell a story, and the reason I'm saying it is because she introduced it, but it was a story that I often use and tell in class, and I'm curious to get your reactions to it. I was introduced, I think, formally to the environmental movement in 1966. I remember it had to be in the fall of 1966 because I was taking this course in field education in seminary. And I walked in to visit a professor with whom I had an appointment, but he was busy, and so I sat down in the waiting room with the secretary. This was a seminary that was located in New York City, and this particular office where the secretary was located on Broadway, which is not one of your cleanest streets in the world. In fact, I would probably declare it to be, next to Los Angeles, one of the most polluted streets I could possibly sit by day in and day out. Well, as I sat there, I spied the wall on the windowsill, a wide window wooden ledge, and on that windowsill was the most lush growth of potted plants I'd ever seen in my whole life. And I reflected on that for a moment, where my wife and I lived three blocks to the west, which was supposedly a little bit cleaner because it was right on the Hudson River, and that doesn't guarantee cleanliness, of course. Wherever we put out a plant, it just sort of shriveled up and died. And I wondered at this amazing sight that I had seen, sort of felt like Moses at the burning bush, wondering how this thing could be like this. And so I inquired of Barbara, which was her actual name. I said, "Barbara, how is it that your plants do so well and mine all shrivel up and die?" And she said to me, "My plants have souls and I talk to them." And I said, "The hell you say?" And ensued a debate about her assertion that her plants had souls. She steadfastly maintained that they did, and I steadfastly maintained that they didn't, that only human beings have souls. And so I've thought about that over the years, and I'd like to hear what you say. Do you think plants have souls? Now, the other night when you introduced that, everyone seemed to agree. I wonder if people, do you think plants have souls, Carla?
I'm not sure I understand what soul is.
Well, you said it the other night. Yeah, I'll call you on it.
I think they have plant souls.
Do you talk to your plants?
I don't have any plants.
For the same reason you don't.
I now have plants, and I now believe they have souls. I won't try to define what a soul is for you, but I now believe they have souls, and they do a lot better since I all of a sudden changed my conceptuality. Does anyone else feel the same way?
Well, my mother spoke to her plants very much and very loving and very kind, and she had the most beautiful plants. People used to walk by. We lived on a side street, the big dining room window, and people used to walk by just to look at mother's beautiful plants. And in a little small town of Montana, and the local florist used to come down to get snips for mother's plants to start. But she always talked to them very much.
What do you make of all that?
And she used to pray with them.
What do you make of all that?
Well, I think they have a response. They're a living thing, and they have a response.
Response. So if you treat them right, they may respond to you.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Well, you're supposed to talk to them. I think it's your breath going out on the plant.
You exhale carbon dioxide, they inhale, or whatever they do, carbon dioxide, and that feeds the plants. And I've heard that one before, too.
You've also heard that plants do better if there's a musical background.
Musical background?
So that would take care of the.
How do you figure? Big in this response business?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Just that I feel that plants do better if they have music attendant.
Some plants have
electrical fields. And if you have electric, we have electrical field too. So in our, well, why doesn't it? I got close enough to all my parents to shriveled up and died, and my electrical field didn't help them.
Sure, I don't know. You know, I'm a believer that plants do have, that they're living things.
They have souls.
They influence.
And you could communicate to them.
Well, not necessarily communicate, but.
There's
a response. Well,
it's an insurance exercise, proper to me.
Is there anyone here who doesn't believe plants have souls? Can I hear the other side? You look like a proper skeptic sitting back there. The skeptics always sit in the third row and lean back with a certain assurance. I won't say arrogant assurance.
Go ahead.
But he looks like he can take it. What do you think? Why not? I agreed with you in 1966. I agreed for you, with you for many years. I've changed my opinion, but I understand why you believe. No, I don't understand why you believe. Why do you believe what you do?
Plants. That is a, we got plants around the house. I shouldn't tell on my wife, but I told her finally to get plastic plants because the suckers are always dying. And maybe we didn't talk enough to the things, but I think it's stupid to talk to a plant. I mean, I got enough things to talk to. Probably.
What does your wife think? Do you agree with him?
They all died. My father had a greenhouse that he puttered in, and he would bring me the beautiful, healthy plants, and I'd take him back the empty pots, and he'd refill them and send them back to me again, and we had this little thing going.
What, the figure, what do you figure was the matter?
I didn't take very good care of them.
Hostile.
They got water, and then they're supposed to grow.
Right. You didn't care for them.
No.
I think they have feelings.
I think in order to have a soul, you have to be capable of cognitive thinking, or thinking, to be able to perceive that you exist. If I felt that grass had a soul, I wouldn't I think that would be
I don't think they have souls, but they might have feelings.
Cut your hair and your nails.
What's your definition of soul? You said you didn't know it, I
think you're right. Obviously, we could the discussion quickly gets into definition of souls, which I'm really not interested in defining at this point, because what I'm really looking at, of course, is the attitudes that are involved towards nature. And the way I felt, the way I was raised as a child, was to look at nature as something that it was inconceivable for me to think at that point in my life, and I was age 26 at that point, inconceivable, I think, for me to conceive that that plant, what she was saying, had an ounce of truth. Actually, we got into this long discussion, and I remember walking out of the room, and she said, I said, you know, in typical male fashion, plants don't have souls, and she just sat there and smiled at me. And all these years, I thought about that, and it wasn't too many years later that I came to the conclusion I think she's right, not that I want to get into some academic disputation about what souls are, but what she was really conveying is an underlying attitude about what I think you're talking about, which is a sort of reverence for and a capacity to be related to nature. Mm-hmm. Now, Carl has been talking about that a lot and has been very helpful. I don't want to spend my time repeating just what she says, but I want to say that there are certain attitudes that we have inherited. I want to summarize them very quickly, maybe get some discussion. I think that there are attitudes towards nature which are getting us into trouble today, though at the time they developed, I think that they had a certain capacity to help people think in certain right ways. It's just that the situation has changed. The reason the situation has changed in the 20th century is that we have developed some awfully powerful technologies which are now enabling us to intrude on natural systems in a way that was never possible before. And one of the aspects of technology that has assisted us is to allow us for disease control, which has allowed our species to accelerate its population growth in an unprecedented way. So the combination of many more people intruding much more heavily in the environment is causing problems. So that's a multiple causation. But part of this attitude business is added. And we've talked in various sessions that Carla has had, one last night and one this morning. And I would like to add some things to what she said. She talked this morning and last night about an anthropocentric attitude towards nature. An anthropocentric attitude, because an anthropocentric, a human-centered attitude has no attitude towards nature. And the reason we're in trouble is because for so long we have emphasized those elements in the tradition and more lately in the culture which are human-centered. Now one can understand, and I want to insist, that there is a certain naturalness and goodness to being things being anthropocentric. Just because it's gotten us in trouble doesn't mean that being centered on our species at times isn't important. I mean, human sin and distress still exist, and finding deliverance, redemption from sin and distress, of course, still are consistent problems. So we want to concentrate on the human. We don't want to just because we're causing intrusion in nature, we don't want to throw out human beings. So some anthropocentrism is still valuable. What is being criticized here, of course, is the heavy emphasis on that to the exclusion of our human relationships with nature. We can talk about four relationships: the God-nature relationship, the human-nature relationship, the God-human relationship, and the human-human relationship. We could distinguish those four kinds of relationships. What we really have done in this culture and in Christianity, which has influenced the wider culture — the degree of influence is a matter of debate, but it has certainly influenced it — we have neglected the God-nature-human-nature relationships. And now, today, we're saying not that we have to throw out all anthropocentrism — that would be impossible anyway. It's hard for me to believe that human beings wouldn't spend time concentrating on themselves as a species — but that we've got to consider these other relationships, the human nature and the God nature relationships. We'll come back to discuss these more at greater length, just to make sure I've got my right order. The second, and we also mentioned this today, was a certain hierarchical attitude. Hierarchy, which is, of course, one of the feminist great criticisms about patriarchy today, but it's much more important than that. Now, one can understand why human beings would organize themselves and think hierarchically. There is needs for order in human affairs, and one of the fastest ways — not the best way, but one of the fastest way to get order — is for someone to take charge. And when there's leadership, there happens to be — when you have leadership, doesn't necessarily mean it's a top-down, but there is some sort of structure of decision-making with somebody in charge, and one implicitly sometimes gets a hierarchy from this. But so you can understand why this develops. In the tradition, of course, this hierarchy developed out of both Hebrew and Greek traditions. We read a psalm this morning in the session, Psalm 104, where there was a very strong sensitivity towards nature, but a model of a God which was a dominant, hierarchical, and at the top of the pyramid, and as things went down, things become less important. And of course, in this hierarchy, or as it's called in the history of philosophy, the great chain of being, God sits at the top, and Jesus and the Pope, you know, and so on down, men, women, and then sentient beings, animals that is, and then non-sentient beings, then rocks. And you got a nice, neat, orderly pyramid, which has been used time immemorial to keep people in their place, as well as acting as a fount of order. But it's developed, the thinking is developed. Not all hierarchical thinking is bad. I mean, we'll have a chance perhaps to come back and ask the question later on, if so, in what way are humans superior to animals? Very interesting question. Are we in some way distinctive? Are we in fact at the apex of creation, or are we just this aberrant mutation that has occurred in the last 100,000 years, which ought to be rubbed out because it's messing the works up? Yeah.
I just remember at one time, did not the church debate whether women have souls?
Oh, sure.
And
I'm
just
sure.
Barely. Yeah.
I don't know if it was a debate where there was a vote, but see, women — I'm going to get, that's the third one, let me mention this, and that is, and Carla didn't mention this today, but was implicit in some of the things — a dualistic way of thinking, in which — now this comes, we do know that men tend to think in terms of duality. So this may be a figmentation of the way men are socialized in this culture and in many other cultures, but particularly in the Greek culture. This dualistic way of thinking also arose in a period of Greek thought where things were very pessimistic. And maybe some of you know about this, after the Peloponnesian War, and the thinking of Plato, which had this huge influence on the Western tradition. One of the ways of dealing with very tough times was to imagine, if things were really bad here, there may be a realm which was non-material, that was a realm of perfection, and the task was to get out of here into that realm of perfection. I mean, our whole schemes in redemption somehow are based on that kind of thinking. in a very pessimistic period of time, these kinds of dualistic philosophies are very popular. They offer a way of hope. What I want to say is all dualistic thinking, in some periods it could be hopeful, but what has occurred in our period is these historical, carryover of these historical dualisms, mind and matter, spirit and nature, and this whole understanding that human beings are superior because we have the spirit or mind which communicates with God. And traditionally, women were equated with nature because their function was primarily seen as child-bearing and rearing, which was a more natural function, and the males were ones who had a superior kind of spirit. Thomas Aquinas felt that women were not, the ensoulment of women came about 80 days, with men about 40 days, and women was incomplete. I mean, these attitudes have been very important in the tradition of the church. But it's led to both, and that's the fourth one, to the domination, to dominating attitudes of both women and nature. We see nature as an inferior thing, and we objectify it, and it doesn't have a soul in the sense that I was trying to. We don't see it sensitively, but merely as a resource of production. You read the economics textbooks today, nature is seen almost exclusively as a resource, some sort of resource of value. And outside its money value, it has no value. That doesn't mean that there aren't economists around who are very sensitive to nature, but read mainstream economic textbooks sometime and see if that's not true. Domination, well, we dealt with that a lot. Nature, and side by side is with this, is what's called a utilitarian view of nature. Here, based nature is understood for its use value, utilitarian, for what it can be used for. And human beings, all of the texts in Genesis, are given license to have dominion and subdue. We know that we how to read those texts today and know they do not mean that. They mean a kind of careful stewardship in the original Hebrew, but they do have in the history of the tradition been understood to mean have dominion to use. Now again, I want to say a word about, positively about the domination or dominion of nature. But it wasn't too long ago where human beings were really, in many respects of human life, were at the mercy of natural diseases and so forth. And to say that we would like to have dominion in the year 1000 before Christ is quite different than today, because it was then a statement of hope that they could control some of the forces which were uncontrollable. We now think maybe we can control it, as someone said this morning, but we know from earthquakes that we really don't control it, but we certainly control much larger aspects. And in fact, what we're doing as we approach nature is increasing the rate, for example, of species extinction. Since the human race has appeared in a major way, the rate of other species extinction has increased. So
wouldn't you say that it's more an expanding influence rather than control? And I don't think that we're able to, for one thing, we still don't understand natural processes well enough to be able to predict all of the long-standing kinds of results of what we do. And so I don't think we have control. We just have a big influence.
Well, we are. I think the project is to gain as much control as possible. And this, for example, just an example, the project that's now they're seeking to do is to identify the incomplete genetic structure. I mean, there's some fantastic number of elements have to be identified so that can be controlled, and so the human genetic endowment can in some way be influenced to eliminate the bad things, perhaps up the good things. That's very scary. But I think we don't have control, but we're trying to get control of as many aspects as possible. And we're making mistakes in the process and not doing a very good job and other aspects. And the other interesting thing, of course, the whole importance of technology in this is it's just utterly crucial. We really have we spend little time on. How many of you ever in college or in high school had a course on technology, other than a computer course where you learn to use a computer? But look at the effects and influences of modern technology on this. I never did. No one. It's surpassingly strange. The thing that influences our life more than anything else, modern technology, we spend no time looking at. And the rationale behind modern technology, as all technology, is to control things. And so this vast increase of power, one of the project is to control. I'm very dubious whether we'll succeed in that. And I think perhaps there's a little bit of, perhaps a large amount of hubris in the whole project, good old human sin. So domination. The final one I want to talk about is individualism. It's getting us into trouble. Now, first thing I want to say about individualism is I want to celebrate some of the things that have emerged from the understandings of individualism in the West. And I'm talking about the whole human rights movement that's been a product of the last 200 or 300 years, which is in part and parcel of a strong emphasis on individuals. Prior to that, the humans were controlled by the group. There's always a give and take between individuals and groups. But here, before the emergence of individualism in the West, the group pretty much had sway over any individual, and that led to domination and so forth. Today, we have moved a long way through our emphasis on individuality. But this also gets us in trouble. The good things also, on the back of the good, come right in some of the things that are causing us difficulty. Property rights, which allows a person to do what with his or her property within reason, whatever they want, or at least they expect they can, and so they do things. The phenomenon which is called NIMBY, not in my backyard. Nobody wants to have disposal sites in their backyard, and so forth. One could look at it, the seeking of profit, which personal profit, which causes one to reduce costs. And one of the costs of production, of course, is pollution. So if you can reduce that cost by dumping it on the rest of the people, you would increase your profit. Again, an individualistic move for self over against the larger community. There's this delicate balance between self and individual here, is what I'm pointing to. But the excessive emphasis on individuality gets us into difficulty. Well, those are the five areas that I think are getting us into trouble. And a good understanding of each of these five items, I think we have much to learn from our predecessors, but as a total epic for facing the next few centuries, it's going to be disastrous. And the biblical material was based on some of these assumptions, not individualism particularly, but some of these other assumptions. And we have to reevaluate our tradition as well as the current ethos, which reflects itself in these elements. Now let me open it for a few moments to discussion before I go on to discuss briefly what some Christian responses to this situation, what some Christian responses have been. Does anyone like the comment or question? It's been a very brief and summary kind of analysis. Yeah, Carol?
I think part of the attraction of control is not that the technology has been not only control, but what's been so seductive is that the things we're going to get need be made better for ourselves and for our children. You know, chlorine bleach makes things sanitized.
But you got to agree that some of the things that have happened really have made things good.
And they have in some ways. And I think part of the sense of betrayal that I think a lot of folks feel is the sense that there's a flip side to some of these things that was not foreseen. Mm-hmm. Or in some cases when it's discovered that there was significant and was known about certain things and we were not told, and there's a terrible sense of betrayal as well as an undercutting of the mythology that things are always going to keep getting better.
We weren't told, not just by the people who did it, but we were not told by our dominant ways of thinking either. They betrayed us at certain points. But I want to insist here that one of my efforts here is not to kick down our ancestors for their lousy ethics. but to appreciate how in their time it could have been one thing. And another thing to remember is that our predecessors lived much closer to nature than we do today. They knew natural cycles much better than agricultural cycles. It's only in the last 200 years that the great reversals occurred. Before, 90% were people on the land and 10% in cities, and now it's about reverse or even more extreme. And today we live in urban areas which are more divorced from nature, informed often by an ethic which has catastrophic consequences. At least they were closer to nature and could see the impact of much less powerful technologies. That doesn't make us bad, it just makes us aware of the fact that we've got a lot of work to do, it seems to me.
I just want to bring one thing up. It is true, I'm a former scientist, so this is something that I've struggled with occasionally. It is true that scientists have values, you know, they operate out of a value system. But the traditional approach of the culture that he's in, and it's only been in the last 20 years or so that scientists have actually, after they've seen what uses were made of some of these inventions, that they have become concerned. For example, the bulletin of the atomic scientists is an example. And so, for example, I'll just give you one example, radioisotopes. Now, when you talk about radioisotopes, nowadays there's a concern about how these are disposed of. And they're very, you know, there's a lot of rules about disposing of them. But when they were first used in the laboratory, they were, you know, the priority was to use them and not worry about, you know, side effects. And most of the isotopes, you know, the beta emitters and so on are fairly harmless anyway, you know, and there isn't that much concern about them from a scientific point of view. So what happened is you have this process using radioisotopes, and then people start worrying about the environmental consequences. And it's like 20 years later, you know, that they're all in rules in place to deal with this new phenomenon. Computers, same thing. You know, people develop the technology and you have a CRT terminal, and now they're worrying, 20 years later, they're worrying about the effects of the CRT terminal on the workers, you know, that have to work in front of these terminals, whether the radiation is, you know, harmful, what about eye strain, what about carpal wrist syndrome, and so on. So each technology carries something with it that wasn't anticipated.
And heretofore we have not been paying sufficient attention to those things ahead of time, I think you'd say. I do want to say, I agree with you, and I think actually in the latest round, I think there's been, since about the mid-60s to early 70s, been two rounds of environmental concern. These things run in waves. And the last one, I attribute a lot to the work of scientists through a period of 5 or 10 years from the late 70s to the late 80s, where there was a sort of a lag on environmental issues. The scientists working persistently in that period on many of the environmental problems, identifying such things as ozone depletion and global warming increasingly. I give a lot of credit to scientists for coming to a much stronger awareness. Eventually, though, to tackle these problems, we've got to have a good scientific input, which is impartial. We do know that you can often get out of scientists, they all have an old German saying, "Man is what one eats, man ist, was er ist." Who's paying your freight, you can often get someone to give expert testimony. You know that problem of expert testimony.
But the other problem is the scientist is not a disinterested party. He's usually funded by someone.
But we need disinterested sciences, we need an economics which talks about funding, we need a political will, and we need a set of values. All four of those ingredients in any kind of environmental crisis, there's no doubt about it. And where you get those is the big problem we face today.
Yeah, are those four by me?
Well, I think you need disinterested science. You need to have a factual understanding of the environmental problem. Secondly, you need to have a way of funding it. That is, you've got to pay attention to economics. Paying for environmental cleanup or the investigation of technologies doesn't come out of thin air. You need a political will to enact laws that will keep down individual self-interest, it seemed to me. And you have to have a set of values to apply that. I was at a conference about 2 years ago, and it was an interesting, the last session of the conference was led by economists and political scientists. And they said, boy, we have the sources of money for environmental awareness. We've got the laws on the books. In many places, the laws are adequate. Laws are on the books. What we don't have is any kind of value system to make this an imperative. Mm. And I think, again, points to the awareness of a multiplicity of... and one of the things that happens in our dualistic way of thinking is to separate these things. The modern academy, one of the things that was my major gripe about modern universities, including my own, is that for various historical reasons, we develop things in disciplines. We've done that for good reason. One, that there's a lot of knowledge that you have to understand. And you, not only do you have disciplines, but you have sub-disciplines. The wealth of knowledge is expanded. But we divide up in these disciplines, which are separate from each other, and nobody handles the interdisciplinary kinds of things. And so they tend to fall by the wayside. And we get into these specialties, and I do my thing, he does his thing, she does her thing, and the three never get together to check notes, and so they leave out important parts of the problem. Much more we have to, and one of the antidotes to this is some sort of integrated way of thinking. We can no longer have a kind of dualistic, but we need to talk about integration, we need to talk about relationships, avoiding this hierarchical anthropocentric kind of understanding. Yeah.
Down in Texas, where we happen to live years ago, mm-hmm. Well, forgive me for living there. But, you know, the oil crisis, everybody wanted to have a well on their place or on their ranch. In certain places of the area, up in central Texas, northern Texas, now they didn't plug those holes when they quit, and that stuff is running right into some of the rivers, tributaries, and so forth. Nobody wants to plug them up because who's got the responsibility of that? You know, where's the ethics of screwing up the neighbor's water and his land and so forth, and who's going to go back and do that kind of thing? But we all wanted to have that for our cars to go.
Yeah, here's a another good example right here, sitting in the tailings pile. The company's no longer around. Nobody has responsibility, so the government has to do it, and that means the taxpayer. It's very interesting. That sort of stuff's got to stop. Well, let me just say a few words about some Christian approaches that are now being talked about. I'm going to do this generally. We'll have time to talk about specifics in a subsequent section. There's been a lot of things being done. Things really in environmental ethics got started in the late 60s, early 70s. I said that there was a high water mark in the 70s, then a reduction, and now things are coming back. I was a little surprised actually that they came back so fast. A friend of mine who was leads, I'm a Presbyterian, not a Lutheran, and a friend of mine heads the Social Witness Policy Lutheran Church. He said, come on, be on this committee. And I said, oh, come on, it's not time. No one's interested in this stuff yet. Because there's been about a 10-year period of quietness on it. And he was right. There's been a resuscitation. And there are, I think, what I could identify as three general ways today of approaching the issue of environmental ethics. We can get into some of the specifics of these again at a different time. One is what I will call a utilitarian perspective. The extreme form of this is what's the problem, and this is what we've had generally, and that's nature as something to be used. The extreme form of that, I want to be very critical of, does not relate to nature except as a resource or as a something of value for human consumption. That's the extreme of this perspective. I want to say, however, that there is a valid understanding of use or utilitarian value of nature. I don't want to throw that word or the understanding of use out. First thing I would say in defense of it is that all nature is utilitarian. When an animal eats another animal, when an animal eats grass, it's using another animal for its own sustenance. So that we use other species, even eat them, is not so unusual. It's the processes of nature. And if those processes are created good, as we talk about in Genesis, then the process where one species or one animal uses another animal or one species uses another species for its sustenance has got to be seen as good. Now that may cause a revolution in some thinking. You don't like to see it when a grizzly bear eats a rabbit. It's a rather grisly thing to observe, but it is part of the processes of a good natural order. And as consequently, I would say that we use the animals of other species and even rocks for copper is not in and of itself anything evil. So we've got to talk about a utilitarian ethic, avoiding, I would suggest, the extremes that have developed in the understanding of subdue and dominion, which we talked about this morning. So that's been one view, and it's been much criticized because it's of its past track record as the dominant viewpoint, and it's one that needs to be revised in the understanding of it, but still retained. The second, and which is a middle ground ethic, is what I would call an ethic of stewardship. This is what most of you would, if I could get you to raise your hands, I'm not going to try to do it. My guess is most of you would affirm an ethic of stewardship. The good thing about an ethic of, and by the way, the understanding of dominion and subdue in the Genesis text, its real understanding in the minds of the writers is basically a stewardship ethic. Now the good parts about a stewardship ethic is it understands that we as this generation or generations that are living now take from the past or receive from the past and are to pass on what we have received in at least no worse condition, preferably better condition. It's a basic understanding. It's an understanding of intergenerational, and that means the condition of the earth as well. So it has a past, it understands that some good things were done in the past, and it has a future projection. And by the way, this is just for my own record, it's the one that I hold to, generally, though there are some problems with it. The problems come in is that some people, at least, feel it's still a too anthropocentric ethic. That is, it leaves human beings in charge of things. And since we've messed things up so badly in the past, to advocate an ethic which leaves human beings in charge of the whole of the earth leads to all kinds of difficulties. But a stewardship ethic is here, and it's been probably the central mainline tradition. In the Lutheran Church today, there is being developed an environmental statement, social policy statement, and it has a stewardship ethic, a very strong stewardship ethic in it. The third general approach has, the naming of it is difficult. In philosophy, it's called deep ecology. It's sometimes called a biocentric view, to contrast it to an anthropocentric view, that is to say, it centers on the biosphere or ecology or something like that, the environment rather than on human beings. This has been a very helpful, in many respects, a very helpful ethic. It has developed a deep spirituality towards nature. There's many writings that I would classify in this. Probably the most famous spokesperson for this is a Norwegian philosopher called Arne Næss. Some of you
I think that's pronounced correctly in Norwegian. Some of the Norwegian Lutherans would probably, I think that's right. Anyway, he's a Norwegian philosopher and has developed this. And I want to affirm this view, even though it's not strictly mine, though I think it was Barbara's in my Plants Have Soul episode. But I think what it's trying to do here is to reduce the human intrusion. And some, I think there could be some extreme cases, this which are romantic, not that I want to put down romanticism, but imagine a golden era before the advent of modern technology when somehow we were in harmony and would like to transfer the ethics of hunting, gathering people into a modern technological context, which I don't think can be done, even though I admire many of the ethical emphases of the Native Americans to try to translate the ethic of a hunting, gathering people to a entirely different culture has its problems, not only of different kinds of values, but trying to apply them in entirely different circumstances. Some of the problems are certain romanticism about a bygone age when things were pristine. They weren't. By the way, human beings have intruded on their environment since time immemorial, slash and burn agriculture, the denuding of the cedars of Lebanon, the denuding of the Mediterranean countryside and the ruination of the soil over a long period of time are all examples of societies. And by the way, some studies have been done on past cultures that have attempted, that have misused their environment, and the track record of human beings is not very good. The past record is that often, even though human beings recognize the intrusions, they continue to intrude in such a way until the land is exhausted and the people either starve or have to move on to another location. The problem is we can no longer move on. We are now populating the earth to an extreme degree. And anyway, what I'm trying to point to here is this third perspective, which I would call deep ecology and biocentric. We could, those are the three main categories that are being developed today. We'll have a chance to come back to these. Now, on top of this, and this is the last thing I probably will say tonight in order to open up the discussion, there are three ways in which these are being approached, three ways in which these mainline ethics, development of overall ethical systems are being approached. The first of these is has to do with, I'm going to associate these with some names because you knew Sally McFaig's name this morning. And these are modern, I'll give you some names of people who are writing in these areas. Sally McFaig says what we've got to do is change our images and metaphors. We're talking now about Christian ways of approaching this. We've got to change our basic kinds of images with which we deal with things. So she, instead of talking about the classic Trinity as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, retains a Trinitarian formula and calls it mother, lover, and friend, right? Mother, lover, and friend, right? And talks about the reasons why that is a preferable imaging of the God-human, God-nature relationship than the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. She wants to do a fairly radical trip on the images we have, yet maintaining their underlying dynamic. I think that's why I want to affirm Sally, because she's not changing the underlying dynamic. She's talking about the way we image that. And she's saying that all theology, all ways of talking about God are ultimately human images. It's not a question of whether you're going to image God, it's how you image God. And whether one image does a better job than the other. No image does it perfectly. Now I might add, just as a footnote to this, that there's a huge debate going on in the Lutheran Church today whether Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are or are not actually central to the Christian affirmation. That's a debate going on among seminary professors that you might be interested in. So, we need some radical change models and metaphors. A centrist position is probably best exemplified by a Canadian theologian named Douglas John Hall.
in a book that is very important for the theme of this summer's work at Holden. He works on the idea of the image of God. What Hall does, essentially, is to take traditional language and images and plumb them for their radical understanding or new understanding for the current period. So, for example, he wants to use the word stewardship as the guiding ethical motif, but then he understands stewardship in a very, in terms of, he then plumbs and explores the notion of the image of God. I'll spend some time on that tomorrow night, in order to understand what true image of God or true stewardship really is. And it comes down to, of all things, using Jesus Christ as the center of the ethic, saying that Jesus as a model of stewardship is precisely the kind of model we need for the 20th century for care of the earth. So he takes a very conservative outlook towards the tradition and says it has some very radical things to say about our current era. Interesting perspective. The third, some of you know, may know Paul Santmeier. He's a Lutheran, a pastor in Hartford. Has written extensively in the area of environmental theology. His plan, his idea, is to take underrepresented elements of the tradition and to raise them up into a new understanding. That is to take things that, like there is, you brought up the Psalm 104 this morning, to raise up these neglected parts of Scripture which appreciate nature and express a more empathetic or compassionate relationship to nature, to raise those up and to express them as now important elements of the tradition where heretofore they have been neglected and secondary elements of the tradition. So three strategies to, and three different approaches is what, in general, is going on today. Now, the interesting questions come in the working out of these things, and I've got about 10 minutes left. I could start on that, but let me pause now to let you raise some questions about all this. The interesting questions that are fun to deal with are the following, and I just give a highlight for tomorrow night, some of the things I'll be talking about. What's the question of utilitarian and intrinsic value? What do those words mean? How are they helpful? Secondly, what does the image of God mean, and how does it relate to directly to our subject? The third is a notion of the integrity of creation, a expression that has been used widely in the World Council of Churches, and I think it has some very interesting things to tell us theologically. Another question is the question that I raised before, are we superior to the animals? In what way can we say that? Those are the sorts of things that I'd like to discuss tomorrow night and to develop at some greater length and more discussion format. But let me stop now and let me have your discussion, your comments, your reaction.
You're on the committee for the new look at the ethics.
Of the ELCA, yeah, I'm sort of an observer consultant.
Okay, and you said stewardship is kind of the main line that you're going to. Why not go to the biocentric thing? Would that be too?
Well, you know, my personal opinion is, and why I don't hold it, it seems to me that substituting a biocentric view for an anthropocentric view, you're just reverse the problem. And I think the scripture, in the very notion of the image of God, says that human beings do in some way, and that's what we got to explore, stand out from the rest of the creation, stand out, are distinct from, but not separate from. I think that's the position I want to maintain, is are distinct. And sometimes the biocentric view wants to put us back totally into nature. And I think that's a mistake for two reasons. One, in fact, we don't. We have intruded with our intelligence. And second, I don't think it has a Chinaman's chance. Oh, that's using a fine term. A chance of succeeding. You can't have these sessions without one of you. Excuse me. But I don't think it's got a chance of working, and I think we've got to apply ways of thinking that have a chance with the broader culture, not just with a few people who have developed a very strong and positive sensitivity towards nature. And so I think you've got to take a view that's not either biocentric or anthrocentric. You've got to have a view which accounts both for the fact that we are creatures in nature, in ecological cycles. At the same time, something new has happened with the evolution of the human race. Something new has happened, and I think it's an important project. For the first time, the creation, this creation, I don't know where they are on other planets, but this creation is self-reflective in and through human beings. And that's something that's got to be taken into account in the way you look at the world. And so to return to nature, which is, I'm really pointing to the extreme form of that, not its positive form. The extreme form is not, to me, a particularly helpful kind of ethic.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
How would you characterize the fact that scientists right now are working on a possible plan to avert total destruction of the Earth by thinking of ways to avert disaster as we encounter an asteroid that's going to come from somewhere, undoubtedly, because statistically they can prove it's going to happen. No. We're going to have a collision.
Every 300,000 years, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Supposedly that destroyed the dinosaur population. That's one of the theories. And, we'll get it next. Do you characterize that as extreme stewardship? Or do you characterize it as extreme domination kind of syndrome?
I think it's kind of smart myself.
So how much money are we willing to put into that kind of an effort?
Oh, I suspect we know when those are coming. We'll be able to detect them years in advance and see that the orbit is rather close. And the idea is to launch a couple nuclear weapons and nudge them. We're just nudging them with nuclear weapons into a slightly different orbit, which would avert the disaster. Doesn't seem to be a very large technological problem.
I think maybe there's more of a problem in determining when it's going to happen than you alluded to.
I don't know. I'm not a scientist, so I really wouldn't.
But aren't
you maybe
kind
right.
of ethics that we're dealing with? How much effort do we have put into hypothetical things that we may have no control over, assuming that we do have control over or will have control?
Well, the obverse of that is to just let it happen and have huge mass extinction, which the last time, if that's what occurred, there's still scientific debate on this. Species lived on. The dinosaurs, according to this theory, got eliminated. Maybe it's good because that maybe a lot of the dinosaurs didn't eat the human ancestors and we evolved as a race. Who knows? Now, the question is, do you think that we ought to let that evolutionary pattern be completely to itself? Do you think it's guided, for example, or it's just random? Or now that human beings have emerged to become self-reflective, we ought to do things that are positive with that environment, with also the knowledge that since we sin, that we're going to do some negative things to it, too. What would you prefer?
Well, we may kill each other off anyway as we compete more and more for space and food.
That's a very likely possibility of a nuclear weapon.
So where are we going to put our money or effort in?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm trying to be hypothetical. I mean, posing the question.
Well, I just want to say one thing, then we get out of this. the problem that she brought up is central to the freedom of scientists to do this work. And that's why scientists have defended this to the death, and that is that you don't put a value on inquiry when you start it.
Well, there's limits to the...
There's limits. There's always limits.
I mean, when the scientists work intrudes on other people, they do, say, torture animals or release bacteria that no one has ever experienced into the atmosphere.
No, but I mean,
I hope people clamp on
that. Well, that's true, but it's also true that for someone to develop something like a insecticide, which is works on a biological, works by biological action, which is really the hope of the future. The pesticides do not do what they're, what you're doing is selecting organisms that become resistant. But when do you clamp down on this science? You know, obviously there's been some renegades that have released some of these things into the environment without getting proper clearance. You know,
would you say that agree that with a certain extremes that's true? But maybe the limits ought to come in when the scientific knowledge becomes actualized in a technology. And we have to be very careful about technology. The thing, what differs modern technology from old forms of technology is that all of a sudden with the Industrial Revolution and the scientific discoveries of the 18th century, science got applied to technology. Heretofore they had been separate. Now we've got the science-based technology which has given science its great power.
But
we've got to be very careful in how we apply modern technologies today, because we've seen their intrusive character, and we continue to be, and the ecological systems continue to be victims of those past technological choices.
I'll give you another example. This is one that really shocked me, and then I'm going to quit. Smallpox. Now, there were some people going around.
Led by a PLU grant for the eradication of it.
Yeah, there was a bunch of scientists that said it is possible to eradicate this virus because it doesn't mutate. And they went about it. They got the United Nations involved in it and went about eradicating smallpox.
Pretty anthropocentric, couldn't it?
Yeah, 2 or 3 years after smallpox was eradicated, there was an outbreak of smallpox, because it turns out that someone had kept a stock of smallpox virus for biological warfare purposes. Now,
I don't
how do you figure that out? Yeah, no. It's really true.
And, without being kept.
I think something.
Yeah.
It's being kept so you can develop an antivirus. If something occurs, I don't know what's going on.
But I mean, I'm just telling you, there's all kinds of problems with this kind of stuff. You know, you've got, on the one side, you have people that say, well, it's possible to do it, and then there's the other side that says, well, you know, there's other possibilities.
Well, you're all encouraged to continue this conversation, because we obviously haven't resolved those issues yet. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bob.